Today, updates from 2019. So, the year is ramping up, most people are back at work, and next week, Parliament will resume. So, we thought it was a pretty good time to give you an update on some of the scandals.
After sustained questioning of Angus Taylor last week in the Parliament, it's clear there are questions to answer here.
Changes in legislation.
The people pushing for maximum legal protection for religious belief and religious practice are always pushing the edges, always trying to make things broader.
And legal battles that we covered in 2019.
What we know is that these are some of the most vulnerable people in the country. And so lots of them just end up paying the debts, even if, as the critics say, they could be wrong.
To let you know what has changed and what that means for you in 2020. I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story. Last year, you heard from Claire.
I've been dealing with Centrelink for about 15 years on and off, and it's never been easy. I didn't expect this to be any different, but I didn't expect it to be this difficult.
She was one of 900,000 people who were given a letter that said you could owe the government money. She was asked to prove otherwise or pay up.
So you've been told you have a debt, yeah?
Yeah, I've received the account payable notice and everything. I just wanted to have a look at the report.
Experts say that this process, known as robo-debt, was riddled with flaws and based on faulty maths. It was also the subject of multiple legal challenges. Luke Enriquez-Gomes has been covering this story. Okay, Luke, so when we last spoke, there was a case going to court that was pretty consequential in this whole robo-debt story. Can you just remind me about what that case was? What were the basic facts of it?
So basically this was a landmark challenge to this whole scheme brought by Victoria Legal Aid on behalf of a nurse. Her name is Deanna Amato. And she had a debt raised against her of about $2,500. They were challenging the debt in the federal court, and the argument that they were putting to the court was that using income averaging was unlawful.
And as we know, you know, in our robo-debt app, we kind of went into detail about how a lot of the experts in this space say that using income averaging to figure out someone's debt is pretty faulty maths, right?
Yeah, that's right. So basically the argument is that if you are not looking at someone's entire income or you're taking their income and averaging it over fortnights across the entire year, you're not going to get an accurate picture of how much they were earning at a particular time. And the government hadn't been seeking the full information that it could in terms of pay slips and bank statements from employers. They had relied on people to get that information, and if they didn't, they would process the debt without essentially having the full picture.
And what happened with Deanna's case?
So the case was set to go to trial around the end of November, the start of December. And then just before the case did go to trial, something pretty incredible happened. We learnt that the department had sent around an email to staff at the Department of Human Services saying that it was going to change the system. They said that they were going to abandon what most people say is the central plank of the scheme, what makes it most controversial, which is this income averaging method. And instead, they were going to require additional proof before they processed debts. They were going to make sure that they had all the information before they issued debts to people.
So basically, a big part of this program and the part that had been used to raise debts against a lot of people was being abandoned. That sounds like a massive announcement.
It's absolutely huge. The way that they had made sure that the scheme made lots of money for the government was by taking out that process, which is quite labour-intensive in terms of getting those pay slips and bank statements on behalf of people. Instead, they put the work onto welfare recipients, and that allowed them to process debts much more quickly. So by removing that part of the scheme, it makes it a lot more difficult to recoup the sums of money that they had originally aimed to.
So basically the process that had been used to figure out Deanna's debt, that's no longer a thing. You know, how many people is that going to affect?
So that's true. And Human Services staff have been told that up to 600,000 of the 900,000 robo-debts that have been issued will need to be reassessed. That means that people will have debts that they've issued be analysed by the department to see if they're correct. It's been said that, you know, more than 220,000 people might require a refund or a debt waiver. In saying that, the department itself publicly has been much more tight-lipped about the figures, and at a Senate estimates hearing late last year, they essentially said they hadn't quite figured out the proportion of debts that were affected by this development.
Do we know how this process is going to play out for people who have had robo-debts generated from income averaging? Who's going to get that money back?
People who are already paying debts will have their debts freezed by the department as staff there go through and identify which debts need to be changed and which don't. As part of that, people will have the opportunity to request a review of the debt that has been issued to them. That's no guarantee that the debts will be refunded or that part of the debt will be refunded, but it's likely that many will be, although it's not clear exactly how much of the $660 million raised by the program will have to be repaid by the government.
Is there an estimate at all?
It's expected to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Wow. Okay, so what did happen to Deanna's case after this big announcement a week before, you know, we're supposed to go to court?
So the government decided to settle. And when Justice Jennifer Davies made an order, the court declared that Deanna Amato's debt was not validly made and that the order to garnish her tax return and also to add a 10% penalty onto her debt was also invalid.
What was the core part of her argument that it was not validly made?
Davies says that the government did not have the information it needed in order to prove that the debt ever existed, and so therefore it could not issue a debt. And that is what critics have been saying about this program the entire time, that income averaging does not provide enough evidence to prove that the debt the government says exists actually does. Mm. It doesn't provide a full picture of the person's financial circumstances.
So we have this federal court ruling about income averaging and the faulty maths behind it. A week after this big government decision, do we know if these are linked, this decision by the government to drop income averaging?
It would be hard to imagine a situation where they're not linked. The government was considering what to do with this federal court challenge for many months, and the decision to change the way that it administers the program was made very shortly before, at least we learnt about it very shortly before it decided to settle the case. I guess the other point that is worth making is that in the many months before, one of the big criticisms that was made of the program and the government's administration of it is that whenever it got to a situation where it would go to trial or go to a tribunal which would publish decisions about it, it always decided to settle. And so this avoided the case playing out in court, and therefore there was merely an order made by the court rather than a day or 2 days of the entire thing playing out in a courtroom.
Mm. So is this the end of legal action over robo-debt? Because Deanna's wasn't the only case that was slated, right?
No, that's right. So Gordon Legal also announced a class action last year, and that was supported by the Labor Party. And they say that that class action will continue. As well as seeking debts be waived on the basis that the government had enriched itself through the program, the class action from Gordon Legal also says that the government owes welfare recipients a duty of care and that they had breached this duty of care by issuing these notices, threatening notices, claiming that a debt was owed. The class action is seeking damages for stress, anxiety and stigma.
You have been reporting on robo-debt for a long time and talking to so many people involved. How are the people at the centre of this robo-debt scheme, whether they're advocating or have personally been affected by it, how are they feeling right now?
The news that the government was going to abandon income averaging was met with surprise, shock and elation, I suppose you would say, from the critics of the program and people who had been impacted by it. We're talking about a wide gamut of people, from legal experts and welfare groups through to welfare recipients themselves who had been caught up in the program. They were all incredibly happy that the government had been forced to take this decision. There are still questions unanswered about how the process will go from here. I mean, in terms of the way that reviews of debts will be undertaken, as well as what the scheme will look like in future. The government is not saying that it's no longer going to recoup money. It's just saying that the way that it's going to do that is going to be different. The difference, we know, means that it will be a slower process and it will not be able to issue debts in the same speed and scale that it did previously, but there will still be an income support debt program of some kind. So certainly people who are advocates in this space are looking to know what that scheme is going to look like, as well as the people who are likely to be impacted by it.
In 2019, the government released a draft bill on religious freedoms. It was hugely controversial, and some were concerned that it could act as a license for hate.
It just licenses more vicious speech by religions about others and by one religion about another. And in particular, what it releases absolutely explicitly is the right of religious people to humiliate other people.
Paul Karp has been covering the story. Okay, Paul, so last time we spoke to you, the Attorney General, Christian Porter, had put forward a draft bill on religious freedoms, and he was considering at the time certain alterations based on a bunch of submissions that he had received, but he was keen to get it before Parliament by the end of the year. What has happened since then?
Well, they missed the deadline.
Why did they miss their deadline?
They missed their deadline because there was concern, particularly among conservative religious groups, that the bill wasn't an advance on their rights at all.
What right were they not getting that they wanted under the old version of the bill?
They were worried that the current state laws and the absence of a federal religious discrimination law allows them to select people of their faith in things like aged care and hospitals. But if the first bill went through, they wouldn't be able to do that anymore. So they wanted further exemptions to be able to discriminate on the basis of religion for their own institutions.
And was this the main reason behind the delay of this bill?
Yeah, so even before this bill gets passed, you know, the Senate, it actually has to go through the coalition party room. So before they worry about how, you know, Jackie Lambie and Labor and One Nation are going to vote, before they even get to that stage, the coalition needs to get this through their own party room. And they needed to avoid a situation where people that want a stronger bill, like, you know, Concetta Ferravanti-Wells and Barnaby Joyce, could criticise it. And there were just too many, you know, conservative religious institutional opponents of the first draft of the bill. So to get it through their own party room, they needed to make changes.
Okay, so they went away and thought about those changes. What happened then?
Shortly after Parliament finished sitting and before Christmas, one of a number of barnacles that they needed to deal with before the end of the year was to release the second draft bill.
When it was released, what did it say?
Well, it added exemptions that allowed religious institutions like aged care and hospitals to continue to discriminate on the basis of religion. And those changes were things that we expected. They were things that Christian Porter had flagged. It also made a few changes to try and quell concerns from other groups. It tried to tighten the medical conscientious objection provisions. It tried to tighten the Israel Folau clause to address employer concerns. concerns about how that would work. Mm. But by and large, most of the 11 changes that Christian Porter unveiled were further exemptions to allow religious institutions to continue to discriminate on the bounds of religion. So that was things like an exemption for public benevolent institutions, so things like St. Vincent de Paul being able to discriminate in hiring, which it later said it didn't need. So obviously they could have been consulted more before being used as an example. There were things like allowing religious camps and conference centres to discriminate to address the concern that the Sydney Anglicans didn't want to rent Anglicare campsites to Satanists. And there was an extra protection for associates of religious individuals so that it would be unlawful to discriminate against friends and relatives of a religious person because of that person's religion.
So would it be fair to say that the changes mostly strengthened the rights of religious organisations?
Yes, most of the changes were allowing religious institutions of one form or another to continue religious discrimination. And only a few of the changes were on the side of the ledger that LGBT groups and human rights bodies had asked for.
What out of these changes caused the most reaction, the most concern in the public?
Well, ironically, despite the fact that the medical practitioner clause was actually narrowed, that has become one of the most controversial elements of the bill.
Okay, so what did the old version of the bill say about medical practitioners, and what did the new one say, and where are we at in terms of the law and what it allows?
The old bill had a very long list of medical occupations that could conscientiously object. It included dentists, optometrists, physiotherapists, podiatrists, and a lot of those were cut out. So the ones that can still conscientiously object are nurses, midwives, doctors, psychologists, and pharmacists. Mm. The new rules clarify that if they have a religious objection to a particular procedure or treatment, for example, a Catholic having an objection to abortion or contraception, they can refuse to provide that. But the new bill clarifies that they have to do that for all patients. It has to be an objection to the treatment, not to the person presenting in front of them or with their particular characteristics. Because I think you're having too much sex out of wedlock, then I won't, you know, prescribe you a contraceptive device.
Mm. So you have to say no to prescribing the contraceptive pill to everyone rather than
yes.
just particular people. Is that right?
Yes, although it's still very unclear how this is going to work. For example, when you think of transgender people wanting hormone treatments, does that mean that you have to reject all forms of hormone treatment? You have to have a religious objection to providing HRT, to women who aren't transgender in order to refuse? It's still unclear how that's going to operate.
What are some examples that this particular section, the medical practitioner section, would allow?
The example provided in the government's own explanatory materials is a Catholic doctor refusing to provide contraception or a nurse refusing to participate in abortion procedures. Mm. Other examples given by stakeholders include pharmacists providing the morning after pill to women, or doctors refusing to provide post-exposure prophylaxis or PEP to people who've had a sexual encounter that means that they want that protection against HIV/AIDS. Mm. So those are some of the examples causing particular concern.
So what else has been of major concern with this updated bill?
Well, although there were 11 changes made, one of the areas that wasn't touched from the original bill is the fact that religious statements are exempted from federal, state and territory anti-discrimination laws. This was something that Labor MPs like Tanya Plibersek and Penny Wong have raised issue with, and a lot of stakeholders, and particularly human rights group and LGBTI groups. So they point to examples like a single mother being told that she's sinful for denying her child a father, you know, a woman being told that women should submit to their husbands, a psychiatrist telling someone with depression that she should look forward to the kingdom of heaven, like it's sinful to have mental illness or disability. Those are the sorts of examples that people have seized on that are things that could breach other discrimination laws but will now get protection from the religious discrimination bill.
What was the immediate reaction after this updated bill came out?
Well, human rights groups and LGBT groups said it didn't really do very much at all to address their concerns. And by far the most positive reaction was from conservative religious institutions, because they had had most of their demands met in terms of continued ability to discriminate on the grounds of religion in their staffing.
What are the steps forward for the bill, and how unusual is it to get to a third draft for a bill?
It's pretty extensive consultation. I think after another round of consultation with stakeholders, you'll get small refinements to the second bill before it's introduced to Parliament, and it will then be part of the political contest that I won't try and predict where it will end up.
Thanks, Paul. Last year, we covered a couple of controversies surrounding the Energy Minister, Angus Taylor. In November, he was referred to the New South Wales Police over a doctored document. And since then, that's been passed to the Australian Federal Police. In a separate controversy, the minister also narrowly avoided an official inquiry for failing to declare his interest in Jamland, a company he partly owns that's under investigation for the illegal clearing of grasslands. In our episode, we detailed a Guardian investigation that uncovered a series of questionable links between Angus Taylor, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg, and the grasslands legislation. Lisa Cox has been covering this story. Okay, Lisa, welcome back to the pod room. When we last spoke to you, you had been looking into Angus Taylor and Josh Frydenberg for a very long time. And it seems like you were gathering more and more evidence that they were looking into how to change this grasslands legislation, that Taylor's family business was being investigated for breaching. What has happened since then, since last year?
So since last year, or perhaps I should take a step back, late last year, we submitted another Freedom of Information request, and it was, we sought access to a number of things, including any proposals or briefs, including drafts that the department might have prepared that proposed changes to the legislation that protected the grasslands that were at the centre of the Jamland investigation.
And what was what did you get back? What was the biggest revelation in what you got back?
The biggest revelation in the document pack that we got back at the very end of last year, just before Christmas, was a handwritten note from a senior bureaucrat in the Environment Department, Stephen Oxley. And that handwritten note records a conversation with a staffer in Josh Frydenberg's office.
What does that note say?
So the note is dated the 9th of May 2017. So this is actually later than any of the documentation that we have received through the course of this investigation. So it just shows how long running these conversations were in the department and between the minister's office. And the note is headed Monero Grasslands, and it says, "Heads up, re-grasslands. Minister keen to see if he can accommodate Angus Taylor's requests." It then continues, "Want a how-to for Minister in the event he wished to amend or delete thresholds."
Okay, so there's a few things to unpack here, but it sounds like, you know, it's evidence of some further correspondence between Angus Taylor and Josh Frydenberg. Mm-hmm. Do we know anything about what Angus Taylor's request is that's mentioned in this note?
We don't. We have asked him. We've asked Josh Frydenberg as well, and they haven't told us what they asked for. But what we can see is that we've got a handwritten note, and at the top of it, it says, "Minister keen to see if he can accommodate Angus Taylor's requests." And then within two sentences, the same bureaucrat is asking for a how-to guide on how to change the laws. So Taylor has maintained through the course of this very long-running story that any time he has raised the issue of these grasslands, he has been acting on behalf of his constituents in Hume. We don't have a lot of evidence of constituents in Hume that have come forward to raise issues about the grasslands, and we do know that the investigation into Jamland was active at the time that he was making those representations. Taylor has also said that at no point did he ask Josh Frydenberg or the department to make changes to the law that protected the grasslands. But what we've got in a handwritten note from a very senior bureaucrat in the department are dot points that contain his interpretation of what Josh Frydenberg's office was asking him to do. And those dot points refer to a how-to guide.
Okay, so what do we know about this how-to guide and these thresholds?
So thresholds are basically the technical term for the amount of native grasslands that have to be present in a particular area before an activity such as clearing or using a herbicide has to be referred to the Federal Environment Department for approval. So it's a percentage threshold, basically. So there has to be 50% cover of native grasslands before you might have to get the Environment Department involved.
Okay, so do we know what happened with this how-to guide?
We don't know what happened with the how-to guide. We did ask the department at the end of last year whether it was ever prepared, and they have said no. We haven't seen anything that looks like a draft version of this how-to guide. We also haven't had responses from Josh Frydenberg's office about why this was being requested.
Okay, so what does this note add to our knowledge of this case?
It adds quite a bit because what it suggests is that behind the scenes there was quite an active conversation going on between Angus Taylor, Josh Frydenberg's office, and then ultimately the department about what would appear to be watering down protections for these critically endangered grasslands. And a reminder, when we talk about these grasslands and when we say they're critically endangered, we are saying that more than 90% of them have been wiped out. And what these notes suggest is that there was a very active conversation going on about changing the laws, that there were very active attempts being made to water them down. Now, we don't know what specific requests Angus Taylor made, but we can see that those requests are being presented in the context of essentially diluting legislation that protects environmental heritage, protects, you know, critically endangered ecosystems. And the one thing that's sitting at the centre of this all is the investigation into Jamland, the investigation into the company that the Taylor family is involved with, and the investigation on the property where these grasslands have been poisoned.
So obviously the government is going through another scandal to do with the possible breaching of ministerial standards right now with Bridget McKenzie, and that's playing out very rapidly. How have you felt watching that play out?
Look, I think the sports scandal is playing out exactly how a scandal like that should be playing out, in that it appears that this potentially will be a scandal that actually brings consequences for the people involved. Now, whether it leads to a broader interrogation of the systems that have led to the scandal remains to be seen. The difference with the grasslands case, of course, is that despite each new piece of evidence, there don't seem to be any consequences for either of these ministers at all.
That's it for today. If you liked this episode, don't forget to subscribe to the show. Just search for Full Story on whatever app you get your podcasts on. We'd also love to hear what you think about it so far. So if you're on an app that has ratings and reviews, let us know. Thanks to Luke Enriquez-Gomes, Paul Karp and Lisa Cox for their time. You can read more of their reporting at theguardian.com. You can also hear their full original episodes from 2019 on your podcast app or on the Guardian website. This episode was produced by Jake Morecambe, and our executive producer is Miles Martignoni.